This is the Saturday Night Live Friday Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at Westgate West in San Jose, California on June 2, 2000. Our speaker is Bud B. of Campbell, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Bud. I'm an alcoholic. You guys ready to hear my fifth step? I don't know if I can talk about me for an hour, but I'll sure give it a hell of a go. I'd like to say welcome to the newcomers. This is a place where you kind of walk in because you ain't got a clue, and we're the last house on the block. And if you've got another Dodge, go run it, because you'll wind up back here anyway. That's my story, and I think a whole lot of other people have had that same experience. Saturday Night Live is my home group, and my sobriety date is January 15th, 1988. For those of you who can count or care to, that's a little over 12 years. And that kind of impresses the shit out of me, because before I got here, the longest I could stay sober was about a week. And that was my absolute dead-level best shot from the time I was about 17 years old. Now, there were times when I didn't drink because the ship was at sea and there was no booze underway, or because I was on restriction and couldn't get off the base. But the rest of the time, I was drinking on a daily basis, almost every day, from the time I was 17 to the time I was 47. I did take a little sabbatical from booze for a while, and I used marijuana instead. So that's kind of to let you know how long it took me to get here. Other people are fortunate. They get here as teenagers or in their 20s, and some people wait till they're 30 before they get here, and some people do like I do and wait till they're old before they get here. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My dad was an alcoholic playboy, and my mom was certainly trying to square him away. And every time he'd come home with beer or whiskey on his breath, she'd let him know about it. And so he wasn't quite as ready to come home when he had beer or whiskey on his breath, so she used to take it out on me and on my two younger brothers. So, you know, I saw her being insane, and I saw him having fun, and I thought, shit, you know, I want to be like my dad, you know? I mean, he's having all the fun here. So I'm one of the very few people I know who started off life as a small child thinking that being an alcoholic was a cool thing. I mean, I didn't know what an alcoholic was, but I thought Dad was having fun, and that's what he was. Now, home was kind of a battleground. Most weekends were spent in shouting matches. And so my folks were kind enough to get me out of that by sending me to a fundamentalist Christian church in the South. And I'll probably identify it later by accident. What I learned there is if you're saved, if you've taken Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, things are going to be cool. And things were not cool for me. Things were very uncomfortable for me. I hated my life. I didn't like where we lived. I didn't like my clothes. I didn't like the people I went to school with. I was always the last person chose for teens. You name it, I had the problem. You know, I figured, well, geez, you know, if you got this magic God who can do all this stuff, I think I'll sign up for this. So I was baptized at the age of 9 or 10, and it didn't work. It just didn't take, you know. My parents didn't love me, or they wouldn't be fighting, and God didn't love me, or they wouldn't be fighting. And so, I mean, God didn't love me, so I was kind of on my own. And we'll get back to that part later in the story. But I kind of grew up as an alienated alien. As soon as I could leave the insanity of my home, I coerced my parents into signing enlistment papers for me to go into the Navy, and I left home when I was 17. So when I got in the Navy is when I found all this wonderful stuff called 3.2 beer. And they sold it, copious quantities of it at the rec hall, and I did my part in drinking as much of it as I could. And it wasn't long before every time I got a chance to drink, I did. When I was going through tech schools, they didn't let us drink during the week, but I was blasted every weekend. When I got to the fleet, every time I could get into town, I was drinking. When we went to sea, every time we pulled into port, the first place I headed was someplace where I'd get shit-faced. And all my friends have marvelous pictures and souvenirs of Japan, and I can tell you the names of the three bars that were closest to the gate, and that was it. I mean, that's as far as I went in Japan as far as being a tourist. And we got to the Philippines. The story was the same thing. I drank my way down one side of the street in Olongapo and back up the other side of the street in Olongapo. And that was my experience on a Westpac cruise. And I came back to San Diego and was stationed at NAS Miramar and continued to drink there. Well, all good things must come to an end, and so the enlistment in the Navy came up, and so I got up and was going to do my wonderful thing. And I couldn't find a job, mostly because I had trouble getting to interview sober. So it seemed like the Air Force was recruiting at the time, so they had nicer clothes, sharper clothes and nicer clubs, and so I went into the Air Force. And I was in the Air Force for 8 years and drank my way through that. Fortunately for our nation's defense, there were other people besides me to look after you. Now, I couldn't stand anymore. I had this keen alcoholic mind, and it told me that I should be a civilian. So I happened to get married while I was in the Air Force, and we had a baby. And when I got out of the Air Force, I think the Air Force got tired of me about the same time I got tired of it, and my wife was damn sure tired of everything. So we all went our separate ways. And I wound up working on a little island in the South Atlantic by the name of Ascension Island. For those of you who are sketchy on geography, there's nothing around it but water, and it's a long way from anywhere. The one saving grace is that they sold booze cheap. This was back in the late 60s, and a quarter would buy you an old-fashioned glass full of scotch and ice. And if you really wanted to go first class, you could spend 30 cents and get 20-year-old scotch. And a beer was a quarter. And so the only thing to do on Ascension Island for recreation was to drink or watch the sea turtles lay eggs. I found out that you could watch the sea turtles lay eggs while you were drunk. So that worked out pretty well. And I came back to the States for school in Minnesota. Stayed drunk the whole time. I can't tell you anything about Minnesota except where the bars were closest to the hotel. And I went back to Ascension Island, I'd be damned if I didn't drink my way out of there, too. I'm the only guy in the history of Ascension Island who ever missed an airplane leaving because I was drunk. And so when I did get on an airplane, I decided I wasn't going to go back to Ascension because they'd leave your ass there if you were drunk. So I got on an airplane and came back to the States, and I wound up here in Silicon Valley back in the late 60s, and this was the center of the universe for electronics. And despite it all, I was pretty sharp in electronics, so I kind of found a home, and God, did I love the party here. Jesus Christ, you know. And I can tell you the name of the three bars that were closest to Ampex, which is where I started working in Sunnyvale in 1969, because that's where I went. Every day when I got out of work, I went to Michael's, which is still on El Camino Real, in the old Odyssey Room, which was on El Camino Real in those days. There were some really neat places downtown Sunnyvale, but they bulldozed them in 1977 to put up that god-awful shopping center. My God, don't they know people drink in those places? There was John's and the Night Watch and a few choice places like that that are no longer with us. So that's basically what I did, is I drank my way from job to job to job here in Silicon Valley. And I finally got the ideal job. I finally wound up with what everybody loves to have. Because I'd worked in so many places and knew so many different people, and was a glad-handing alcoholic that I really was, I knew a lot of people. And, of course, I've got a line of bullshit, like most of us, that you coat on the wall. So I became a headhunter. And the organization I went to drank like I drank. And God, did we have fun. Along about noon, we'd break out the beer, and we'd start drinking. And this was in one of the boom times in Silicon Valley, and this was back when the semiconductor companies were still all here. I think the only two out-of-town outfits were Motorola and TI, and all the rest of the semiconductor industry was located right here in Santa Clara County. And so I was busy recruiting people to go to work in the semiconductor industry and staying drunk. And I went through another marriage. I went through a home. I went through that job. And, you know, time's going by, and I'm not getting any younger, but I'm still drinking. And I thought, you know, my real problem is this valley is my problem, you know. So I decided I would go explore other parts of the world. And I got to Colorado, and my God, they had a party going there you wouldn't believe. Boulder, Colorado, and the late 70s was just roaring. And at the time, the unofficial cocaine capital of the world. Not that I partook all that much, but, you know, occasionally a plate would go by and I'd have packed my nose. But my main claim to fame was a lot of alcohol and a lot of grass. And I settled down in Colorado for a while, and I moved from Boulder down to Colorado Springs, and it was gorgeous, and I was having a good time, and I was just convinced that the good times were going to go on forever because, you know, I was making a whole lot of money, and I had never been accustomed to making a lot of money, and I'd made a good living, but not a lot of money, and here I was making a whole lot of money, and, you know, I was precious, and I drank a lot, and I drank expensively, and I'd fly my girlfriend in from California, and we'd get drunk, and she'd fly back, and, you know, I mean, it was an insane existence. And then all of a sudden, the booze caught up with me, and all of a sudden, I couldn't pick up that telephone and make phone calls, and all of a sudden, that marvelous income dried up, and all of a sudden, the bills came due. And I thought, you know, my real problem is I'm stuck out here in the backwoods of Colorado. I think I'll go to Texas. And so I went to Houston. And Houston was just a rock and roll town. They were having a wonderful time down in Houston. There was a huge oil boom on. Headhunters were getting rich. I jumped right in. And about the time I jumped in, the oil boom went bust. And headhunters weren't making a dime because nobody was hiring anybody. Everybody was firing. So, oh my God, look what I've done now. So here I am in Houston. And I was fairly close to my original home. And you know, I got to visit with the folks for a while, but I thought, well, I really belong in California, so I came back here. And just before I came back here, it finally dawned on me that alcohol was a problem. Now, alcohol was the solution up until that time, but before that, people would say, you know, you got a drinking problem. I'd say, no. If you have my problems, you drink too. I got a drinking solution. And so that was kind of the way I handled my alcoholism when my mother talked to me about it. And, of course, my dad really didn't have a whole hell of a lot of room to talk because he and I used to get shit-faced together. And we used to tell each other we ought to stop drinking one of these days. Well, one day I was watching my dad on the porch of our East Texas home. And it didn't look like he was going to make it. And it scared me. It scared me seeing. I knew I was going to be him if I kept drinking the way I was drinking. And scared as I was, I talked to a friend of mine about it, and he says, well, you know, you ought to try Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, there's some really wonderful people over there. So all this is during a time when the recruiting business is folding, and so I wound up going to my first meeting in 1982 at the Post Oak Club in Houston, Texas. And that is cotton out of ears, stick it in your mouth, plug in a jug. We're staying sober no matter what kind of sobriety, and they're real with it. And it's a very spiritual kind of thing. I mean, they talk about God a whole lot in those meetings. And, you know, I didn't want to hear a whole lot about God because God was somebody that I couldn't depend on because God already said he didn't love me. You know, I mean, he's already proved that when I was a little kid, but I couldn't remember making that decision. It's just that, you know, I wasn't too hot on this God idea. But I was a very intelligent fellow, and I listened very carefully to what all the alcoholics had to say. And what they said is, if you're an alcoholic, you shouldn't ought to drink. Okay, I can handle that. And, you know, and I do believe I am an alcoholic. I don't think it's going to take a whole lot of proof on that case. So I decided that I won't drink and I will go to meetings. So I went to meetings and I kind of saw the steps on the board, analyzed them. Give you my my analysis of them if you wanted to hear it. Nobody really wanted to hear it, but anyway, I picked up a 30-day chip in Houston and decided to move back to California because the jobs weren't all that hot, so I wound up back out here. And we were in the middle of a recession, and I kind of went to some meetings, and California AA was so different from Texas AA. You know, I went to meetings in Sunnyvale, and what I kept hearing there, and I think you hear what you want to hear, I kept hearing that if your career was on track and your Beamer was running okay and your relationship was working, that God was working in your life. Well, I didn't have a Beamer and didn't have a job, and what's-her-name didn't want to have anything to do with me. And so, God, I guess God wasn't working in my life, you know. And I decided, well, geez, I can just leave these AA meetings where they are. God, they're having fun over there. Don't go join them. I made my keen alcoholic mind said, well, geez, you know, all I got to do is just don't drink. It's cool, you know. And then I decided that really what my problem was not the area. It was I never found the right woman. So I decided what was really going to fix me was go to find the right lady, and as soon as I got married and got settled down, things would be okay. So I started looking for women. And, of course, with my alcoholic personality, the ones that I attracted were the ones that were pretty neurotic. We were well-matched because I was pretty neurotic. So here I am with all these neurotic women. And to take the edge off, I tried a little mild non-habit form of marijuana. And on a daily basis for a number of years, three of them. And, you know, my career followed the business cycle. When it was up, I was making money. And when the business cycle was down, I wasn't making money. So it was up and down, up and down. And I'm not smart enough to save any money, realizing that this is going to be a cyclic kind of a situation. So when I had a lot of money, I spent a lot of money. When I didn't have any money, boy, I was begging. So that's the way it was. And so smoking a lot of dope and occasionally having a little sip, but knowing that, boy, you really can't do much of that alcohol. And that finally put me into a desperate strait. I didn't have any money. I couldn't afford to buy any more dope. I was about ready to get kicked out of where I was living. And so I decided what I really needed to do was go out and spend some time at the Veterans Administration Hospital. So I did that. And they took me in for a couple of weeks. And I decided, well, I don't want to be here because being in a schizophrenia ward when you're not a schizophrenic is probably like being in an AA meeting when you're not an alcoholic. It's just not a comfortable place to be. So I moved in with my brother up in Eastern Washington. And knew that dope wasn't a thing to be doing anymore, so I tried booze one more time. And one more time that I tried the booze laid me on my ass really quick. In less than 6 weeks, my disease was right back where it came from. I couldn't control my bladder. I couldn't control my bowels. I couldn't tell you what time I was going to wake up, what time I was going to go to sleep. I knew that if I had a beer, I was going to keep drinking. And it was looking pretty damn dismal. And I got to thinking about, well, Jesus, you know, the only thing I got going here is I've got this old motorcycle that will go really fast. And these are all two-lane roads around here, and I'll bet you I can find a truck and bore sight that mother. So I was thinking about committing suicide but going and doing a head-on in a semi. And one morning from someplace it says, the only people that knew what they were doing in your past were the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not sure where that message came from, but it certainly wasn't for me. This is a small little town in remote eastern Washington. The only thing that goes on there is there's a huge dam. But there's like five or six small towns in a 10-mile radius, and I don't think any of them has 1,000 population. But in that group of towns, there were five AA meetings a week, and I found it. And my sponsor was the grand old man of sobriety up there. He had two whole years when I went to see him. And so one more time again to try to stay sober yay way. But my little problem that I had with all this is these things talk about God. And, you know, I knew God wasn't going to do anything for me. I mean, he'd do things for you, but he wouldn't do anything for me. I kind of sort of did at the steps. And then I decided, well, what I really need to do is I need to move back to California. So I came back to California. My keen alcoholic mind at work one more time. And this time I've managed to stay in California the whole time. I was dry and going to AA meetings and angry and in a rage and kind of not fit to live with, particularly since I was living with myself. Went through a whole lot of roommates, house to house to house, and kind of did a bunch of very insignificant jobs. Kind of smoked a little more grass, but then, too, I realized that grass was really not good for me and that the grass was going to lead me right back to alcohol. And so finally I got a sponsor and I got serious. And whether these steps would work for me or not, I was going to try them. You know? I was going to try to stay here. I didn't want to drink anymore. I didn't want to use marijuana anymore. I didn't want to use any more drugs anymore. So some of you know Robert R. He was my first sponsor for sure in this sobriety. He and I worked together for a while, and then he got really busy with three jobs, a fiance, and a 17-year-old daughter who moved back in with him. So he really didn't have time to spend a lot of time sponsoring. So then I had Rick C., who a number of you know. And Rick is probably one of the most... Rick is one of the most spiritual people I know. When Rick had 30 days, he was halfway through his ninth step. And, the guy's is a giant, and yet he tells the raunchiest jokes I ever heard. You know, I couldn't figure out how in the hell God could allow this, you know. So, Rick moved to San Diego, and then Tom Olson was my sponsor for a while. And so I was driving in here tonight, I saw old Chevy van looked like the one that Tom used to drive. Tom died of a heart attack December 13th, 1997. Oh, I'm sorry, 96. He was delivering some stuff from his business, and he was in a customer's house, and he had a massive coronary, and he didn't live to hit the floor. That was really a shock, you know. I mean, it's like, woo. Life gets real. You never know how much of it you're going to get. Tom didn't know. Nobody had any inkling that Tom had a bad heart. And so I was coming up on a birthday, so I waited until after the birthday, and John H. is now my sponsor. Sometimes I talk to him, and sometimes I go a long time without talking to him. I'm still not doing this the way that... it's written, but I think that if we look under in the small print, it says nobody can claim perfect adherence to these principles, and I'm certainly one of those. The only thing I can tell you is since January 15th, 1988, I haven't smoked any grass, and I haven't had any booze, and I haven't had any cocaine, and I haven't had any prescription drugs that the doctor didn't give me and prescribe, I'm living a fairly clean life, so that's the one thing I've done perfectly since I've been here. And, the things that I've done in sobriety, that I've been allowed to do in sobriety, would take, God, the rest of the meeting for me to tell you about them, so I think I'll do that. One of the things I always wanted to do, and I'd be sitting on a bar stool thinking all these wonderful storylines, is I always wanted to write a book. And I really wanted to write a book. So, the way I work is contract, so I work about 8 or 9 months a year, and I'm on layoff the rest of the time, and I'm usually sitting at the computer running some kind of story by it. So 2 years ago, I got to publish my first book, and it's published on the Internet, and it's crappy, and it's terrible, and it needs a whole lot of work done on it, but at least I got the damn thing finished, you know, and it took forever to do that, you know. And I always wanted to go see things and do things, and I was always sitting in the bar with a bunch of guys, wishing that we could have a bunch of girls with us, but we didn't. And we'd always be talking about what we were going to do when we got off that goddamn bar stool, you know. So I get a chance to go do that, you know. Recently, I've had the opportunity to take a new contract position, And it's with a company that's doing some magic stuff. Out of an 11-person crew, five of them are PhDs. And, you know, I get to go to work in a two-acre toy box every day and play with all these marvelous toys they've got there. And they pay me good money to do it. And I love it, you know. And that's one of the things I would never have been able to do if I'd have been kept my ass on that bar stool. I think the people who pick up corpses would have been around to pick me up a long, long time ago if I'd have stayed on that bar stool. You know, so I'm able to do things in sobriety that I never had any thought about being able to do when I was drinking. I always wanted to do them, but boy, I just never got around to doing them. You know, and to compare my life with what it used to be like, you know, when I got here, I kind of kid around and say I was a high bottom drunk. I got here with all my own teeth and a driver's license. And, you know, today I have an automobile, and it's registered, and it's insured, and I have a valid driver's license, and I live in an apartment and pay taxes and work and do all those kind of things. I'm even a registered Republican. I mean, that's something that I never thought would happen, but, you know, I vote. Not that I'm necessarily proud of being a Republican, but, you know, what's the alternative is worse. Oh, my God. You're a Canadian. I've kind of fallen back into something like normalcy. I mean, I do normal things today, but I'm not a normal human being. I'm an alcoholic. You know, I've heard a lot of people stand at this podium and say that drinking is not an option. And I'll say bullshit. Drinking's always an option. That's the reason I come to these meetings. Now, that's one of the reasons that I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous. Next Tuesday, I'll be taking another meeting into a locked facility over in East San Jose. And these people are mentally ill. And I don't know if they appreciate me being there or not, but they really jump on the Lord's Prayer like it's going out of style when the meeting's over. And the thing I get when I get out of there and get a breath of fresh air is I get a huge sigh of relief knowing that if I keep doing this, I probably won't have to do that. So, you know, that part of my life is working very nicely, thank you. I've taken some people from this group to chair that meeting for me. I remember one time there was a couple of guys went over with me, and when we got outside, they had the 1,000-yard stare. I mean, they couldn't believe what they'd been seeing in there. And, you know, that's the alternative to doing what we're doing. Is when I talk about institution, jails, and death, that's the institution. And it's a very sobering thought. If someone's free and wants to go check it out, come with me Tuesday. I'll be very happy to have you. And you'll be real happy to walk out of that place and knowing that you wanted to go back. And the thing about it is a lot of those people drank and used their way into that place. And, you know, I see that, and I just know that that is, but for the grace of God, go I. About 10 years ago, I moved into a little apartment down on, over by D&J Hobby, and been there for 10 years. And that's when Saturday Night Live was at the old Campbell High School. And there was a guy that had been living in one of the apartments. I guess he'd had a falling out with his roommates, and he moved out into his car, which was parked on Ontario, for those of you who know Campbell. And he lived in his car for a while, right out there in the front. And I guess the people got tired of him doing that, so they burnt his car up. And so he started pushing a shopping basket around and canning for a living. And he got a DUI sometime in that period, and he came to Saturday Night Live because we used to be close to the DUI school. And, you know, today I saw him walking down the street. He's lasted 10 years living on the streets as an alcoholic. He's an active alcoholic. And he just kind of wasted away. I mean, used to, he was a slight man, well-muscled. And, you know, now he's lost so down. He's gone so much without eating. And that could be me. You know, I see that. That could be me. You know, that could be anybody in here. You know. I'm absolute awe of how tough he is, because I don't think I could live 10 years that way. I mean, we've had, by and large, California has wonderful weather, but I remember one year that it was about 13 degrees out there for about a week or two in a row, and it was cold out. And then El Nino about floated everything around here off. I don't know where in the hell anybody would stay on the streets in a case like that. And, last February wasn't all that bad as far as rain goes. I mean, it rained a bunch. And, you kind of wonder where the street people go. And that could be me. And that could be anybody in here. And I'm just grateful that Saturday Night Live was here, because Saturday Night Live was a group that I immediately made an identification with from the first time I came here. It had the high spirit. It had a lot of people doing a lot of things. If you look up here at our service group, I think we have more people in group service than any other group I'm aware of. And if you are around and about in Alcoholics Anonymous and you go to any of the conventions or any of the do, and you look at the people who organized, it was people from Saturday Night Live, or usually about a third of the people are sitting on the boards. And so this is where I learned about sobriety, and I learned how to be in service. And this is home. I am still a brat, and I still run away from home a lot. But this is home, and I'm really glad to be in my home group. Life has become very meaningful. The people in this room are very meaningful. I was here when a number of you got here. And let's see who was in here when I got here. I don't think I see anybody. Now, they're probably all getting ready for the party tomorrow. But the old Saturday Night Live was a big, happy, raucous, noisy, high-energy group. And over the years, we're getting fewer and fewer people who are getting invitations from the judges to be here for a DUI. At that time, we were located right next door to the DUI school, so we were getting a whole lot of people that go to school and come to us, and we're having this party going on, and so they stuck around. So I guess I've seen probably 10,000 people come through Saturday Night Live in the last 12 years. And some of them stayed sober and moved to other places, and then a lot of people I just don't see anymore, and I kind of wonder what happened to them. They came here and they were part of for a while. I lived with a guy named Jake O. And Jake did about 7 years with Alcoholics Anonymous and then decided he didn't need us anymore. Haven't seen him since. I often wonder how he's doing and how his wife and kids are and that sort of thing, where he's at. And Jake's not by himself. And then sometimes you can come to a meeting and you'll have somebody say, "Hi, Uncle Bud," which happened tonight. And I said, "How did that happen?" And he says, "Well, since you were at my first meeting, I decided everybody at my first meeting is going to be my family." So, I am now Uncle Bud to one of you guys. But I've been to a lot of first meetings when people came here. And if you're new with us, Alcoholics Anonymous is the absolute best deal going for alcoholics. We have a success rate that is phenomenal by comparison to anything else. And our success rate, I want you to hang on to this, okay, those of you who are new, our success rate is 1 in 10. And if you're new with us tonight, the odds are 9 to 1 that you'll die drunk. And that's awful, but that's the nature of this disease. This son of a bitch will kill you dead. The only way I know to beat those odds are these 12 steps. I told you that I had this real serious reservation about God. It wasn't until I was sober about 12 years and I'd gone out there and been doing life real good and having a good old time doing it. And lo and behold, I got in the way. And it was painful and I had to write another fourth step. And in the process of writing that fourth step, I got to revisit that time in my childhood when I made that decision that God didn't love me because my parents didn't love me. And I was able to get that worked out. So today I have a God of my own understanding. And he was not issued to me by the Southern Baptist Church. And I am very pleased with the God of my understanding because he seems to be able to take me like I am. And we seem to get along okay most days. He doesn't still see things my way most of the time. And so I'm still working on that. I'm glad you're awake. Let that be a lesson to you. If you sit up front, you get the jokes. Not that there have been that many. And one another thing I've done is I've had the pleasure of working with several men who've gotten sober and stayed sober. And every now and again I get an email from them. I don't know if any of you remember Luke M., but he's living in Capitola these days and writing software and driving people to the airport. And God, Marcus isn't here tonight, Marcus Miller. He came through here a while back, and he came back again, so I've sponsored him. I think he's about ready to move off again to a better place. So it's been kind of fun to work with the people who I've had the benefit of sponsoring. And also another thing is a whole lot of fun around here, birthdays. And Andrea and Shiloh are both 5 years old today, I think. They're both five? Yeah, both five. And today's June 2nd. Today's their birthday. So if you see them, tell them happy birthday. Ken is Shiloh's fiancé, and he's normally the secretary, and I think they're probably out having a party tonight. Big party tomorrow for all the birthdays. I'm trying to figure out what I can say for the next 25 minutes. Does anybody have any ideas? I told you I couldn't go very long with this. Yeah, I'm just so grateful to be sober. I'm so grateful to Saturday Night Live. I'm so grateful to the people who were here when I got here. And I'm really grateful to the people who showed me that this thing works. Because without the people who came here and showed me that by living what's in the big book, they could stay sober and have productive lives, I would never have tried this. If this was just going to be a theory that nobody was living, I'll pass. But I've seen so many people here live this and have productive and prosperous and happy lives. And I want to thank you all for mine.